This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
With Joe Biden now the American president, the prospect of a resurrection of the Iran nuclear deal is dramatically back in force. And Iran has taken the opportunity to announce that it's just weeks away from nuclear breakout. This all leaves the state of Israel in a very precarious position. This week, it made an unusual announcement that it is preparing to stop this with force. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, there was a very important speech by the Israel Defense Forces Chief of Staff, Aviv Kochavi, on Tuesday. And this is a speech in which he said that Israel has no choice but to draw up operational plans to strike Iran, to block its nuclear advancement of its nuclear program. This is what he said, quote, "Iran can decide that it wants to advance a bomb either covertly or in a provocative way. In light of this basic analysis, I have ordered the IDF to prepare a number of operational plans. In the addition to the existing ones, we are studying these plans and will develop them over the next year. The government will, of course, be the one to decide if they should be used, but these plans must be on the table in existence and trained for." And then he said, "Iran, if it were to rush ahead, could be months, even weeks away from a bomb." And so what's very unusual about this is that this is not a politician speaking. This is not the prime minister of Israel speaking. Benjamin Netanyahu has been notorious for the past 12-15 years speaking up against Iran's nuclear program. This is the chief of staff of the army that has said, coming out and saying, we expect Iran to get there, and we now need to figure out how to destroy Iran's ability to create a nuclear weapon.
Brent, talk about the timing of this relative to the Biden administration taking power now. What does the signals that Washington is sending now as to how it will deal with Iran, and what sort of message is Israel trying to send?
Well, this week there was a bit of a communication on social media between and with state public statements between Joe Biden's administration as well as Iran, where the U.S. says we want to go back to a nuclear deal as soon as Iran starts complying again with the terms of the deal, which means reducing its nuclear stockpile and all the other things that they're breaking. Then the United States will comply. And then Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, comes out and says, well, we'll start complying when the United States starts complying. So when you get rid of all the sanctions and give us all our money back, then we'll start. And so this is just the initial stages of working towards a deal. Both want a deal, or both wanted a new Iran deal. What Kochavi's came out and said also is that the old Iran deal was horrible, and the new Iran deal will also be horrible, indicating that Israel is not going to support any type of negotiation with the Iranian regime. He said that the Trump administration right now has created the perfect leverage on Iran because of the crippling sanctions. If they're already suffocating, this is not time to give them air, as he said. But all the moves from the Obama administration are that we want a deal. You had Robert Malley be installed today. He is one of the chief negotiators of the old deal. This is a very much a pro-Iran man. I saw a tweet of somebody that I consider quite knowledgeable in these on Iran and the nuclear deal in Iraq and what Iran's doing. And they had a picture of Javad Zarif laughing at the rejoicing at the announcement of Malley as the Iran envoy, because he is such a pro-Iranian fella that he's going to be a pushover at the in the negotiations, because he wants an Iran deal. Israel's very upset with this announcement that O'Malley is going to be the Iran envoy. So they want a deal. Israel knows they want a deal. And Israel's general here, he wouldn't speak out unless it was headed in that direction. He is a close, he works in tandem with the prime minister. It would be very much, although Netanyahu hasn't confirmed it, it would be very unlikely that he has said this without the approval of the prime minister. This to me sounds like it was very reminiscent of the 2015 speech, a landmark speech that Prime Minister Netanyahu gave it before a joint Congress. He was invited by the Republicans, you remember, because Obama was about to push through a deal that the Senate and the House of Representatives have said that they would not support. Remember, there was this big question: if this is so popular, if this nuclear deal is a great idea, then surely you could have Democrats signing up for it as well. But Obama couldn't get enough Democrats to sign up for the horrible deal in 2015. That he had to just do an executive order to make the deal happen. However, Netanyahu wanted to come and give this last-ditch appeal to the American people and to rapturous applause, I might add, of Democrats and Senate and Republicans because it was such a bad deal. Now, he's not going to do that again. He's not going to be invited to speak there in the United States again. And so here you have a very public figure of Israel coming out and saying that this is going to be a bad deal. And if you go ahead and do sign this deal or do negotiate a new deal, we're ready to strike it down straight away. We are going to act regardless of American approval, which some Israeli leaders have said this is a bad idea. If you disagree, disagree in private. Don't jeopardize the American-Israeli friendship. I think Kohavi is acknowledging something that Netanyahu acknowledged, and that there is no backdoor communication between the Obama administration or the Joe Biden administration in Israel that could deter them from going ahead with a deal with Iran. And so we have to make it known publicly that Iran is pushing towards a bomb, and we're going in cohort with the United States, and we are going to be forced to put a stop to it ourselves if we can.
Really, one of the strongest points that Gerald Fleury has made so far about the Biden administration is just how much it represents a return to the Obama era. And you're talking about these individuals now that Joe Biden is putting into his administration that reflect this holdover from these failed policies. The Iran nuclear deal, he called it the worst foreign policy blunder in American history. And the fact that in spite of all of the evidence that Iran has been seeking nuclear weapons all along, that Biden would continue to proceed with trying to negotiate and trying to act as though Iran is a good faith actor in these types of negotiations. This really does put Israel into a corner, and the fact that they would have to take action to defend themselves really should come as no surprise.
Right. It is no surprise. I mean, you look at the personnel, as you say, it's all the same as the Obama people. They want the same deal. It is a mystery to many that are looking at this of why go after this deal? Why go after it so with all the energy that you have to jeopardize your relationship, all your other relationships in the Middle East, all the allies, Israel, Gulf states, they're up in arms with this. They love the Trump moves. And yet it proves that this administration is just a copy of the Biden administration. And Mr. Fleury wrote in the Barack Obama Mystery a very important article that people need to go and read. The pertinent section about Iran and why Barack Obama wanted to do with Iran is two-thirds the way through that article. So don't give up with it. Keep on going through it and see that these are not moves, or Barack Obama's moves to empower Iran wasn't a hopeful empowerment that if only we could just bring them alongside us and not be adversaries, then maybe they'll like us. It wasn't just a misdirected effort. This was an effort specifically designed to empower Iran because it's an anti-Semitic nation. That is why the Obama administration empowered Iran and gave them so much money, because they are the regime that is willing to use force on the state of Israel. Barack Obama said, I'll take care of the United States internally. I'll fundamentally transform the United States. And he outsourced as Mr. Flurry talks about it, taking care of Israel to Iran. These are both motivated from the same place. Both these actions about transforming America away from its traditional values and the empowerment of Iran for the detriment or for a future attack of Israel are motivated from the same spot. And it's a mystery to everybody out there. A lot of people studying why the Obama administration and Biden administration are going for this, and they can't make sense of it. They know it's bad. They know it's horrible. They know it's obviously bad, and yet they pursue it. And people really need to find out the roots of why the Biden administration is going after this.
Well, that's very good advice. Read the Barack Obama mystery. We will also link to the worst foreign policy blunder in American history in the show notes for the program today. You do need to understand that, and we will continue to watch how this situation develops and what Israel does about the change in political administration in America. Thank you for that, Brent. China has been taking over the South China Sea and militarizing this strategic area, pushing back against other nations over disputed waters. This week, it made a bold announcement showing just how determined it is to wholly claim these waters. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Chinese government has passed a new law that for the first time explicitly gives permission to the nation's coast guard to fire on foreign vessels in disputed waters and to demolish structures built by other countries in those same waters. So, you know, China has disputes with Japan over parts of the East China Sea. It also has disputes with Taiwan and basically half a dozen Southeast Asian nations over parts of the South China Sea. And its Coast Guard in the past has chased vessels from other nations, especially fishing ships and vessels helping with various parts of drilling operations out of those disputed areas. But a draft of this new law says the Coast Guard can now use handheld, shipborne, or airborne weapons. And it says it can, quote, use all necessary means to stand up to foreign vessels. So this is about authorizing them to open fire. It also specifies that the Coast Guard can board vessels and inspect foreign ships. And as I mentioned, it can demolish structures that other nations built on islands and other features there in the South China Sea. And then it's notable that this is the Coast Guard that we're talking about here.
Right.
Because, you know, a Coast Guard is supposed to be for search and rescue and for policing and, you know, explicitly not for overt military operations like this. Defense analyst Chester Cabalza wrote about that aspect of it this week. And he said that the law was a game changer because it transforms a white force meant for policing and search and rescue into a menacing gray arm of the military. And then you also have to remember that this is talking about areas that are either international, you know, mm-hmm. they're supposed to be open to fishing and exploration by anyone, or they're areas that are actually the exclusive economic zones of other countries. So for China to be stepping in and saying its Coast Guard can open fire on other ships for being either in open water or in their own water, you know, it's just, it's brazen beyond words.
China's made a lot of pretty stunning moves to take control of this area. This seems like it's about the most aggressive, openly aggressive move that it has taken. Is there any relation, do you think, with the change in administration in America? What is it that provokes the timing of this move?
I'm not sure if there's actually anything that has to do with the changing in administration, but there was a very notable freedom of navigation operation that the U.S. just conducted, actually under the Biden administration. But for the first time, they sent a aircraft carrier battle group through the Taiwan Strait, right in between China and Taiwan. I don't believe an aircraft carrier group has ever gone through there before. And, you know, China was just up in arms about kind of the display of force that the U.S. had in what it views as probably the most sensitive waterway in its periphery. So some of this could be a result of that.
And how are other nations in the region responding to this?
So far, the Philippines has really taken the lead in speaking out on this. And that's been refreshing, I think, because over the last few years, we've seen a lot of worrying capitulation by the Philippines to China, including even with President Rodrigo Duterte. But now, seems like they're really speaking up boldly. The Philippines Secretary of Foreign Affairs filed an official diplomatic protest to Beijing in response to this new Coast Guard law, and he called the law basically a threat of war. And then Fernando Hicop, the head of one of the Philippines' main fishing associations, he issued just an especially blistering statement about this. Part of it says, "The Chinese Coast Guard can now shoot anyone, armed or unarmed, in territorial waters that they illegally claim." And then he called it a virtual declaration of war that will stoke Filipinos' hatred of China, end quote. So, you know, I think it is admirable that the Philippines is standing up to China over this, because it is just an incredibly provocative move from Beijing. And it does set the stage, I think, for some serious conflict in the South China Sea and possibly even the East China Sea.
Now, as firm as the Philippine statement against this was, really this is very much in keeping with a trend that we've seen and that is very prophetic in terms of China bullying its way to the forefront of the nations in Asia, and actually those nations really ending up with no choice but to give in to China.
Yes, that's right. We're seeing, you know, despite some statements that may come out from nations like the Philippines, for the most part, they are just terrified of China's rising power and its willingness to use that power. So they are being kind of, you know, pressured into capitulation. And that's something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has specifically written about with this whole South China Sea dynamic. In an article that he wrote in the July 2016 issue of The Trumpet, he said, "Since World War II, America has protected this vital trade route and brought peace to this part of the world. Now the American military is retreating, and China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will." And then he said, "China's behavior in the South China Sea is, quote, steering the world toward war." And in that article, he goes on to explain that his whole understanding of that dynamic is built on Bible prophecy. He spends quite a lot of time analyzing Deuteronomy 28:52, especially. That's about the nations of Israel. And in modern times, that means mostly the U.S. and the U.K. And in that passage, they're warned that if they don't turn to God, he will give control over the world's strategic sea lanes and sea gates to their enemies. So, you know, Mr. Flurry says that China's expanding military capacity and its, you know, just increasing belligerence in this area shows how fast this prophecy could be fulfilled in the South China Sea.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremiah. Last week, Donald Trump bid goodbye to Washington and Joe Biden took over the presidency. But Democrats and opponents of President Trump aren't taking this as an opportunity to stop their attacks on him. For this story, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, that is a really good point. You'd normally think that now that the Democrats have won the White House and President Trump's gone back to Florida, that they'd take a chance to take their ease and enjoy their victory. But if anything, it seems like the attacks against President Trump have intensified this week, with two big events happening on Monday. The first being that the Democrats walked an article of impeachment to the Senate. And the second is that a major voting company in America has sued Donald Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, for defamation. On that first story, the article of impeachment, there's just one this time, accuses President Trump of incitement to insurrection, specifically of willfully inciting violence at the January 6th protest at the Capitol building. That article, if you actually read the text of it towards the end, it says, "Donald John Trump thus warrants impeachment and trial, removal from office, and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States."
And so, honor, trust, or profit. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's that is interesting language. The first one should be fairly easy. The removal from office part. It is almost kind of funny that you're impeaching someone, which is a process to remove you from office, mm-hmm. when you are not, in fact, in office. There's actually quite a few questions about the constitutionality of this. Is that mm-hmm. the Constitution's pretty clear that impeachment is to remove someone from office. Therefore, it follows that you can't impeach someone who's not in office. The Constitution's also pretty clear that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is supposed to preside over the trial. And John Roberts has pretty much washed his hands of this whole thing, saying he doesn't want to be involved in any way with impeaching, trying to remove someone from office who's not in office. It's just silly. Mm. So they'll get one of the Democrats to preside over it, but it's almost like a sham phony chance to accuse Donald Trump of insurrection that's not going to hold legal water, which is important because that second point they said, and disqualification to hold or enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. That's there's a section 3 of the 14th Amendment says that anyone who's taken an oath to the Constitution and then been involved in insurrection against it is permanently barred from holding any public office. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the main reason they chose their one article of impeachment to be incitement for insurrection. Impeaching them for anything else would just be a normal impeachment. Impeaching them for insurrection bars him from office forever.
That's really what they want.
They want him to go away permanently.
Right.
Their chances of getting it are pretty low because you'd need a 2/3 majority in the Senate, and I think at least 45 Republicans right. have said that the Mitt Romney might go for it, but most Republicans aren't going to go for this.
Yeah.
It's not even a real trial because the Supreme Court's not involved,
mm-hmm.
But it does reveal their agenda. This is to actually keep him from running again at any point in the rest of his life.
Yeah. Now, in other news, Trump's legal team that has been trying to prove voter fraud, they're being attacked as well.
Yeah, that happened the same day, Monday this week, where Dominion Voting Systems, they're a huge voting technology company in America. They provided equipment and software to 28 states during the last election. And they issued a 107-page defamation lawsuit against Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, on Monday. And that lawsuit, it accuses Giuliani of what they call a big lie, quote-unquote. And they said that big lie went viral, deceived millions of people into believing that Dominion had stolen their votes and fixed the election. Mr. Giuliani had claimed that there were many irregularities with the Dominion voting machines that were stealing votes from President Trump, giving them to Joe Biden, and rigging the election. And apparently the claims he made are convincing enough that millions of people believed them. And now Dominion's, they're suing them for $1.3 billion for making these claims. And that's not the only lawsuit they're doing. This is the one that they issued on Monday. But earlier in the year, on January 8th, they issued a very similar lawsuit against former federal prosecutor Sidney Powell for claiming that Dominion did the same thing, also for $1.3 billion. So together, that's $2.6 billion. As far as I can find, that's like 26 times Dominion's annual revenue.
It's a lot of money from two people.
Yeah, so they're getting, yeah, a generation's, literally like a generation's worth of revenue from these two lawsuits. Although neither Giuliani nor Powell seems too intimidated by this. Actually, Giuliani made a statement on Monday, following up on Dominion's lawsuit, saying Dominion's defamation lawsuit for $1.3 billion will allow me to investigate their history, finances, and practices more fully and completely. The amount being asked for is quite obviously intended to frighten people of faint heart. It's another act of intimidation by the hate-filled left wing to wipe out and censor the exercise of free speech. And then I think later on in that statement, he said that he's looking into a countersuit against Dominion. Ms. Powell making similar things, not quite as publicly as Rudy Giuliani, but on Telegram. She's been kicked off Twitter, so she's on another social network now. She actually said there's mounting evidence that Italy helped hack our elections. Dominion may have ensnared itself. Under the law of defamation, Dominion has the burden of proving falsity, which means Dominion has to prove by admissible evidence that it did nothing wrong regarding the election and the machines. And so what basically she's saying is like, oh, well, okay, they sent me for a defamation suit, but the burden of proof that what I'm saying is wrong is on them. So now in the discovery process, they have to open up some of their internal documents to prove that they didn't, in fact, rig the election, which is a bad idea if they did, because it does give Trump's legal team some access to information it wouldn't otherwise get. So one way or another, you've got Mr. Giuliani, Ms. Powell, and several others saying that Dominion machines were used to steal this election, and then the Dominion team coming back saying that's all a big lie. Now, don't have to be an expert in logic to deduce that they both can't be right. And there's a lot of money on the line here. There's $2.6 billion. So in the weeks ahead, we are likely to see some impressive legal action as these two legal teams go at each other, trying to conclusively prove for the American people to see whether Dominion helped rig the election or not.
Well, we just last night sent the March 2021 edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet, the print edition, to press, and we have a whole lot in there about how to view what is going on here. We have on the cover, we've got a picture of Joe Biden with the headline, "The President of the United States, asterisk." That's also the title of Stephen Fleury's article in this issue. And Gerald Fleury has a really big article, bombshell article, "Why I Still Believe Donald Trump Is Coming Back," that I would really encourage you to read. That will be going up on the website next week. And there's quite a lot in here about this, including a sidebar that he wrote about the inaugural of Joe Biden. Stephen Fleury also has a sidebar about illegitimate leaders and looking at the Bible's view on illegitimate leadership, and an article by Gerald Fleury on America's broken judgment. So it's about half the issue devoted to this, and I would really encourage you to watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. The Italian government has fallen. To learn about this and what it means, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte resigned earlier this week. Right now, the president is leading 3 days of discussion to try and decide, well, who has the best chance of forming a new government. Now, we did cover the start of this saga a few weeks ago here on this show. It all started when the former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi pulled out of the coalition. It deprived the coalition of a majority in the upper house. It didn't cause the coalition to fall right away, but I guess Mr. Conte decided that he didn't have the support, he couldn't continue as a minority government. So he resigned. Like I said, they're still in this discussion period. I think it's a real it puts Italy's unstable government on display, I think, in a lot of ways. You know, Giuseppe Conte has an approval rating of 52%. That's pretty high. He has the approval of most Italians. Matteo Renzi has an approval rating of 2%. Yet this politician with a pretty tiny approval rating is able to derail the whole government. And I think 45% want Conte to stay on. That could happen. So I think Conte would like to emerge at the head of a new coalition, maybe encouraging some new parties to support him, maybe finding a way to get Renzi back online and get him behind him. Otherwise, there are plenty of other candidates that are waiting in the wings there. And It could take a while. Italy is not a country where you have two main political parties, a left and a right wing. There are a lot of parties. There are a lot of very small parties. They've made some changes that have gotten rid of some of the very smallest parties and have made things a bit more stable. But the fact that you have these pretty small parties can end up tipping a coalition one way or another does often make these coalition negotiations very lengthy. Meanwhile, of course, you've got the economic fallout from coronavirus continuing. You have got the European Commission and the European Union waiting to hear from Italy on their spending plans for the bailout. I don't think they get the bailout money until Italy come back to Europe and say, this is how we're planning on spending it. They can't do that without a government. So the clock is ticking, but nobody really knows where we go from here.
Richard, how big of a deal is this these internal conflicts in Italy to the wider European project?
Yeah, the Foreign Policy magazine had a really good article this week. I guess the title is a bit lengthy, taking a page from Beijing's Belt and Road. Rome is positioning itself as the center of trade, energy and transportation in the Mediterranean and beyond. Quite a mouthful, but it makes a very simple point. You know, we tend to look at Italy as a bit of a basket case, as the sick man of Europe, and I think it is in a lot of ways. But at the same time, it has still been doing some very significant things over the last decade or so. And it has real reach and real power. The article says Rome is rising over the Mediterranean, this time as an economic power. It talks about Europe's fastest rising economic power in the wider Mediterranean region. It says 2 decades in the making, Italy's focus on trans-Mediterranean commercial connectivity has achieved something akin to a Mediterranean version of China's Belt and Road Initiative, with Italy in the center. Termed Il Mediterraneo Allargato, the enlarged Mediterranean, the map of Italy's rising 21st century commercial prowess looks a lot like the first century map of the Roman Empire. And it talks about all of these different links that Italy is forging all around the area, you know, trading with Africa, building what it calls an energy empire across Libya and Algeria and a lot of other places. So, you know, we focus on Germany most of all on this show and at the Trumpet for very good reason. But you know, Italy is a major European power as well. And we talk about this rising power that's coming in Europe. And you know, the Bible talks about that power. Germany is going to head up that power. But other countries are going to play an important role in that power. You know, France has a lot of bases across this area. But Italy as well will really bring this European power to a lot of dominance across this region. I think when you really look at the influence Germany, France, and Italy combined, these three powers have, you do get a sense of just how widespread the power of a united European country, European power can be. And you know, that is where the Italian political crises in the long run, in some form or another, are leading. We had a fantastic article over the summer that we mentioned last time we talked about this from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. And the point that he just really zoomed in on is how coronavirus is pushing Europe to this direction that we've expected them to go in for decades because of Bible prophecy. This direction of being a united power, a very different power to the way they are right now. And he pointed to the way that coronavirus is building to crisis in Europe. It's stirring a lot of economic crises. In Italy, we see some of that falling over into political crisis. And to solve that, Europe is going to have to make some massive revolutionary changes. And you know, well, what type of changes? Where is this pushing Europe to the opposite of squabbling coalitions that can't get anything done? To instead strong leaders that step in there and do what needs to be done to fix some of these problems. You can really see this increasing the appetite for that. I mean, you see one of the things Conte has been talking about while he's not been negotiating over his government over the last few days is how poor Europe's vaccine rollout has been. And we'll talk a bit about that later as well. But you know, that's another way that this is building to a crisis. People are looking at Europe and saying, well, the way we are doing things just isn't working. We need some big changes. And that's exactly what the Bible talks about for Europe. It talks about in Revelation 13 and Revelation 17, an authoritarian, dictatorial Europe with 10 kings. So different number of leaders, different type of leadership. And so you can see Italy is an important stepping stone on the road to that destination.
Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. We will link to that in the show notes for the program today. We appreciate you bringing that to us. Richard, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're going to take a short break. Stick around.
B- This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The deals the Trump administration brokered with Arab states to normalize relations with Israel look like they included an agreement to sell advanced fighter jets. The Biden administration is putting a stop to an agreed-upon arms deal with the United Arab Emirates. For this, we'll go back to Brent Nachtigall.
We talked about how, by virtue of the Abraham Accords, the Trump administration agreed to sell F-35s, a lot of them. These are the premier fighter jet to the UAE. And along with that, they also agreed to sell Reaper drones to Saudi Arabia. And this was something that wasn't part of the Abraham Accords, but it was done in, let's say, at exactly the same time. And so there was a kind of a quid pro quo nature to the UAE coming on board with Israel, and then the United States providing these highly sophisticated weapons to both Saudi Arabia, but particularly to the UAE. And the act now of the State Department of the Biden administration is to put a freeze on that. They haven't said it's not going to go forward, but they have stopped it from going forward right now. And so this is, I think it's interesting for a number of reasons. One, what's it going to do about the UAE-Israel rapprochement? Is that going to stop now because the UAE is not going to get their what they're in it for? The Israel doesn't expect that. Israel expects this relationship to go forward regardless, just because there's been other buy-in of other nations. And this is the direction that it needs to go if they're going to be protected from Iran. They need to have this collective defense, whether or not the UAE gets these weapons. So that's one part of it. It's also interesting that this wasn't just a decree by the Trump administration. This was something that was put to a Senate vote. The Senate, it was brought forward to try and stop this deal from going forward. And there was a vote on it during the Trump administration in the Senate, and it was unable to be frozen. It was unable to be stopped. So the people through the Senate had decided that this was going to be a deal that the United States backed, that the United States is fine with. This was bipartisan. There was two Democrats that actually said, yes, let's agree to this UAE deal and with Saudi Arabia as well. And so that's what's being stopped here. It's not just a Trump administration move. It's a Trump administration move that was backed by a Democrat and Republican Senate.
So what do you make of this? We talked about the dangers in that deal at the time, and the idea of empowering these Arab states with the with these jets. You know, we don't usually agree with the Democrats. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of how you're looking at this is the big question. In terms of biblical prophecy, we know that it is going to be these nations, the UAE, the Saudis, Jordan, Turkey, even Syria eventually, they're going to make up an alliance that is actually going to be the nations that fight against Israel in cohort with a united Europe led from Germany. Psalm chapter 83 brings that out, that there is going to be a close relationship with Israel first between the Gulf states and Israel, and then there's going to be a double cross. So we were talking about this deal, how it's not worth it for Israel's sake, because you might have this temporary relationship with the UAE, but in the end, it's going to come back to bite you. That still holds 100%, obviously. But what's concerning here is that is the reason why the Biden administration is putting a hold on this. And it gets back to what we said in the first half. There are two major power blocks in the Middle East. Bible prophecy talks about them. And so we see that playing out. You have the Iranian bloc, terrorist element that the United States administration now supports. And then you have the Gulf allies with Israel. And so this decision to limit the weapons that are going to go to the UAE and that would go to Saudi Arabia, at first they might not be used on Israel. The reason the UAE wants them is not to attack Israel, it wants to defend themselves against Iran. The reason that Saudi Arabia wants Reaper drones is not to fight against Israel, it is to most likely fight against the Houthis, an Iranian-backed group in Yemen, where it's waging a war over there. And so by limiting the arms going to these Gulf states, it's another sign that the Biden administration is taking Iran's side and actively stopping the defensive power, I would say, of the anti-Iranian alliance made up by the Gulf states and Israel.
Where would you send people who want to understand this better, Brent?
I think what the best thing people could do is just read our article that related to these peace deals between the Arab states and the Jews, because we talk about these, the dividing or these two biblically prophesied groups or alliances in the Middle East and where it's going to lead. This article is entitled Why the Arabs Embrace the Jews.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Protests against Vladimir Putin are a regular occurrence in Russia, but they never amount to anything. Some say it looks like recent protests may be different. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, I'd like to begin this story talking about something that I'm reasonably sure we've never discussed before on Trumpet Hour, and that is toilet brushes. we've never before had any reason to mention those, but if you look at the streets of Russia right now, you'll see many, many protesters brandishing golden-colored toilet brushes as they protest against Vladimir Putin and his government. So the reason for this is that living standards have been falling for Russians. The country has been in economic decline for a few years now, and last year was especially difficult. Inflation is soaring, poverty rates are also soaring. Many Russians are just really struggling to get by from week to week. And as they struggle, a new video was released of a palace on the shores of the Black Sea that was allegedly built by Vladimir Putin's cronies and gifted to him. So this is, by some estimates, a $2 billion palace. The property is the size of a city. It includes, you know, a helipad, an indoor hockey rink, a casino, a church, even a private harbor. It's surrounded by fortified walls. It even has its own unique border checkpoint. So it's like a nation within a nation. And then there's apparently gold everywhere inside of this palace. So Russians are understandably upset if they're all struggling so much. And meanwhile, they see that their tax rubles are paying for this extremely opulent and extravagant palace for Putin. So, you know, they're out there in the streets with these toilet brushes painted gold to symbolize just how excessive a lot of the extravagance of this palace is. You know, if even your toilet brushes are gold, then that might mean you've siphoned enough out of public, you know, coffers. Mm-hmm. And they're also out there protesting the arrest of Alexei Navalny. That's Putin's main opposition figure. We talked back in August about how Navalny was poisoned with a nerve agent that only Putin's government would be able to access. And Navalny almost died from that, but he did recover in Germany. And then last week, he decided to return to Russia so that he could keep on battling against the, you know, the corruption and the authoritarianism of Putin's government. And upon his landing in Russia, the government immediately arrested him. So he's back behind bars, and many, many Russians, particularly younger ones, are very upset about it. And more than 100,000 of them protested across Russia last weekend. That was the largest protest since 2011, or possibly even earlier. And this weekend, the planned protests could get even larger.
It is not difficult to see why people are so upset when you look at the footage of this this palace, and you see just how difficult life is for people generally. And the Russian government just passed a law outlawing this type of protest, and they're still out there on the streets.
It's a really interesting part of this story. It was a law that Putin passed late last year. It's part of his broader crackdown on dissent, and basically, it allows authorities to label any people or organizations in Russia as foreign agents, even for something like tweeting a tweet or posting something on some other social media platform that's critical of the government. And these laws specifically make it very difficult for anyone to legally organize anti-government protests or take part in those protests. So the police last weekend, they repeatedly told these protesters that the protests were against that new law. And there ended up being about 3,700 people arrested, including 1,400 just in Moscow. So they are illegal demonstrations, and that's a big part of it, because the people just don't seem to care. It's like they've reached a breaking point where, despite the law, despite the threat of arrest, they're still out there. And I think it'll be really interesting to see if the protests this coming weekend end up being as large and as rowdy as many are expecting them to be.
Give us the view that Bible prophecy provides on this.
Sure, yeah. Well, there are quite a few onlookers who say that anti-Putin sentiments are growing so strong, these protests are growing so large, that this really could be the end for him. The Independent said as much this week, also The Observer and The Echo of Moscow. And as you said, it's easy to see why this looks serious. But the Trumpet believes that Putin will remain in office and even survive politically in the longer term, and that's because of what our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has said about Putin's role in Bible prophecy. There are many Bible passages about an end-time Asian power that will bring several countries together into a massive military alliance, and there's a passage in Ezekiel that says this bloc will be led by a prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. That's the way Young's literal translation renders that verse. And Mr. Fleury has been saying since late 2013 that this passage is describing Vladimir Putin. In his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, he writes, "Putin's track record, his nationality, and his ideology show that he is fulfilling a linchpin Bible prophecy. The time frame of his rule also shows that nobody else could be fulfilling the Ezekiel 38 prophecy." So, you know, since the Trumpet has this vital understanding of Putin's role in end-time events, we disagree with those who believe that he won't endure the current protests. Mr. Fleury has said that Putin has already fulfilled part of those prophecies, and we believe that he'll stick around to fulfill the rest of them.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We're going to finish the show with a story about the botched rollout of the coronavirus vaccine in Europe. But before that, I want to give Richard Palmer a chance to give us the executive summary of the lead story in this morning's Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Richard took the show this morning, and Richard, I have to say, you did a nice job of making this this story clear. The explosive popularity of this one silly stock, GameStop. What does this teach us about the American economy?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's one of the funniest stories I've seen for a while, but it does have some very serious points. So GameStop, this seemingly defunct retailer of physical copies of video games, their stock is soaring way out of proportion of anything that they've done. They are now a Fortune 500 company because their share price has shot up just in a matter of days from, I think, somewhere around $40 a share to around $400 a share. And what has gone on here is hedge funds bet against GameStop. Hedge funds said this company is going out of business, and they set up a system where they could profit from that. Instead of that happening, individual fans of GameStop rallied around GameStop, bought lots of GameStop shares in a deliberate attempt to try and break the banks. And they did it. One of the hedge funds needed a bailout of about $2.5 billion. It has ended up costing some of these hedge funds billions. Somebody tweeted, it's easy to laugh over this, but real people are losing their third yacht over what is happening here, which kind of summarizes the feeling. You know, nobody's getting out their violins for some of these rich hedge fund managers that are losing money. But there are some very important points here. I mean, it exposes a moral collapse really at all levels of American society. One of the things that it's exposing is regulatory bodies. We're really getting a good look of how they're in bed with a lot of these big companies and a lot of these hedge funds. Instead of creating a level playing field, they seem like they're trying to help the hedge funds and hinder the individual investors here in a way that is potentially corrupt, because a lot of these executives, a lot of these people working in American regulatory bodies, they get massive speaking fees from the same banks that are now struggling and the same hedge funds that are struggling. So some of the big trading apps that were allowing people to buy funds or to buy shares in GameStop. They've stopped letting that happening. They've now said they'll let it go forwards in a limited way today. So it looks like you do have regulatory bodies tilting the playing field, acting unfairly from selfish motives, and it kind of a very get way of looking of operating there. At the same time, just with all of these small investors and all of these apps getting in on this and absolutely pumping up a stock way out of proportion of what it's worth, you're seeing a kind of the massive popularity of get-rich-quick investment, of gambling on the stock exchange. People just trying to make money tomorrow, not investing as a store of wealth or some kind of long-term thing, not investing because there's any value there, because they want to get rich quick and they want to roll the dice. And one of the things that Herbert W. Armstrong came back to again and again when talking about the global economy is that economic prosperity is based on laws. And one of the fundamental laws is when people are operating honestly and to contribute honest labor, things work and this leads to prosperity. When there's this rampant trying to get, which we're seeing, like I said, every level of this scandal. I mean, this story. There's this kind of small versus big thing here, but at every level, there is greed and selfishness, and that is setting us up for economic collapse. So we're seeing how fragile America's economy is, and when that does collapse, well, that has massive implications all around the world. But then this angle that Mr. Armstrong talked about, it also points to the solution too, and it's leading to God bringing an economy that is based not on getting and selfishness and gambling, but on honest hard work and the give way of life.
It really has exposed just it's like a hole in the entire system when all of these individual investors are able to artificially inflate a stock like this. But this type of thing goes on all the time. It's just that this, because it was done by little guys, it's getting headlines and it's creating a lot of problems that people couldn't foresee. But in a way, what's to stop them from doing this with any stock that they choose? If you get enough people, thanks to social media, in this case, a Reddit board, on board with something like this, they could do it at any time. I'm sure that it's almost like it's exposed the open back of the hospital gown on the patient, the way that they've done this. And, you know, they're going to have to do something. Those who invest, those who are kind of controlling the interests of the entire economy are going to have to figure out some way to prevent this from taking place on some kind of a scale going forward. But that's a great point about just how you see the same motives of greed underpinning all of this that really have the potential to create catastrophic problems for the American economy and the global economy. Okay, so good job, the executive summary there. Now let's talk about the rollout of vaccines in Europe. This is not going so well.
No, as I mentioned, this is starting to cause some big headaches at the EU level. You look at some of the stats. Britain has rolled out enough vaccines that it could have vaccinated 12% of its population. Israel, a stunning 50%. America, 7.5%. And the European Union, they have spent the last year or two talking about how stupid and inefficient President Trump is and how terrible Brexit Britain is. The European Union has rolled out enough vaccines for 2%. So for them to be thoroughly trounced by these people that they've spent the last year ridiculing, that's a lot of egg on their face for this. And it's leading to a lot of anger. This is starting to look like a great advertisement for Brexit. It's getting commentators in the press and in the media kind of pointing at the EU and saying, well, actually, maybe quitting the EU is not such a bad idea after all. We've got this big bloated bureaucracy that is not doing so well here. And how the European Commission has responded to this, I think, is incredibly revealing. They have responded by basically trying to cut off Britain's supply of vaccines. So one of the vaccines Britain uses is the Pfizer vaccine. It's from a German company. And the European Commission is stepping in and trying to block these vaccines that I think they're made in Belgium being exported to Britain. There was this member from the European press complaining that the British press is vilifying the European Union. I mean, setting aside the whole should you get a vaccine thing, you know, deliberately trying to cut off a nation's supply of vaccines during a pandemic is a pretty transparently villainous thing to do. I mean, if you're going to do that, you can't complain that people are painting you out as a villain. But this is exactly how we've talked about Europe responding, you know, imposing trade embargoes to get their way. We've made very specific forecasts based on Bible prophecy that you're going to have Europe working together to create this global trade empire. And then you can look in Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 52, I think it is, that talks about Britain and America being cut off from world trade. And this is the second time in a matter of a month or so that we've had Europe respond to try and punish Britain by cutting them off from trade in some form. We had France using coronavirus as an excuse to cut off Britain's trade. And now you're having this dispute about vaccines, and Europe's like, right, well, we're going to cut off your supply of vaccines in trade. And this is the way that they're thinking, and they're already operating on this level. They haven't reached the position of power where they can have like the full kind of blockade that's talked about in the Bible, but they're moving in that direction. But a good place you can go to learn more about this, Trumpet.com managing editor Brad McDonald had an article several years ago called Trade Wars Have Begun, and it does a great job of taking you through exactly what the Bible says will happen in these trade wars. And then, you know, you can compare that to reality and see how these things are getting started already.
All right. Thank you, Richard. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Dale Carnegie: inaction breeds doubt and fear. Action breeds confidence and courage. If you want to conquer fear, do not sit home and think about it. Go out and get busy. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.